This car is the most honest car you ever see.
It's been a dream ever since I've had it.
The first time I heard that engine screaming, I thought, I gotta have one of those.
For me, the cars have personality.
What's great about a BMW Classic is the community that surrounds it.
When you listen to that, that's why we're here.
Welcome to Classic Heart, the BMW Group Classic Podcast. This is JP. And my guest today turned his passion for cars into a really, really successful endeavor in business. It's the founder of Bring a Trailer, Randy Nonberg. Good morning for you.
Good morning. I'm happy to be here, JP.
We are connected somehow because Bring a Trailer obviously is on many bookmarks for many car enthusiasts, including me. So we're super happy that you have the time. So where do we find you today?
I am at Bring a Trailer's offices in San Francisco, California. We started the business here when I was living here in the city, out of my basement with a friend, and then moved into a couple of fun industrial office spaces. And now we're here in Potrero Hill in San Francisco with some cars in the office and some of our team in the office. But most of our team is remote around America. But I like coming here. It's a very fun office space.
What is Bring a Trailer? For those two noses who don't know what Bring a Trailer is.
Bring a Trailer is now an auction marketplace and community of enthusiasts around cars. And it's a marketplace that we've optimized specifically for transaction of cars and things related to cars. So, but it didn't start that way. It started in 2007 and we turned it on just as a place that I could share about cars that I had found for sale on the internet. And the internet was a crazy place of selling cars at that point, very disjointed, very scattered. And I was a bit of a treasure hunter finding interesting cars for sale and created effectively a newsletter online, a blog type format online to every day tell JP and all his friends about what BMWs and other vehicles I had found that were interesting and for sale.
So, but I could imagine that in the beginning, this was not your daily job, wasn't it?
It was not. And interestingly, I had a career at BMW that I was fostering and enjoyed. Yes, I worked for BMW North America at the time. I worked at BMW AG before that. I was always excited to work in the car business and knew that I wanted to do that. But hunting for cars for sale was always sort of my passion on the side. I didn't watch a lot of TV. I didn't read enough books. Yeah. I looked for cars for sale ever since I was a little kid in the newspaper or in car magazines. And that was always sort of a passion and a crazy obsession of mine. And here it is now.
But when did it all start in terms of the love for cars? Do you grew up in a household that was like car crazy? Or is it just little Randy who started playing with Matchbox cars and getting excited about it?
Good question. So I grew up, I had two sisters and I was the only son in our family. Mm-hmm. And my dad and I had a very close relationship as a result of that. My dad always loved cars and he took me to watch racing and see vintage cars. I was very lucky. He took me to the Pebble Beach Concours. We live about an hour and a half from Monterey. And he took me when I was a boy of, 3 years old. I went and stood next to a Duesenberg I have a photograph of that at Pebble Beach. And I think it was 1980 or 1981. I was 3 or 4 years old. So he fostered a love of cars in me. And I also have a German last name that is unusual in America.
Indeed.
And so I always loved German cars and my family's heritage and that sort of thing. So my dad was a big Mercedes guy. So we had W123 Mercedes when I was a kid. My mother had a station wagon and my father had a turbo diesel sedan. And we were kind of into German cars in that way.
Oh. When were you allowed to do your driving license? At what age?
In California, you can do it at 16 years old.
Okay. Could I imagine that you went there at the day of your 16th birthday to do a driver license?
Absolutely. I remember it was one of the best. I tell people that was one of the best days of my life was when I got to go and get my driver's test 9 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
I had a summer birthday, so I didn't have to wait till the end of a school day or anything. We don't have school in the summers, so I was off of school. I got the very first appointment on August 25th, 1993, and I got my driver's license.
Were you nervous?
sure, I was nervous. In Germany, you have to, you know, you have to practically be a mechanical engineer to pass the test, or a flight instructor. In California, this will not surprise your audience to hear that the test is not that difficult. So I was able to pass and come home and grab the keys to actually the project car that I had been working on even before I was 16, so I could go and drive it. It was great.
What was that project car?
We all wanted Jeeps and trucks and Broncos, and these sorts of things are very popular now. They were very inexpensive then, you know, $4,000 or whatever. So I had a Toyota Land Cruiser, a 1975 Toyota Land Cruiser that had a Corvette Chevrolet V8 in it as the engine. That was my first car, which is very California, crazy California.
So, but then let's skip college and all these kind of things, because we have not that much time, even though I would love to hear some college stories and car stories from you. But how did you end up working for BMW AG, and what did you do?
So I was very lucky when I was in university that I had an exchange overseas program where I came and studied in Berlin.
Oh, wow. How was your German?
I took 4 years of German in high school, and my German was sort of okay for a Californian. And I came to study in Berlin for 6 months. And then I actually had my first practicum, my first internship was actually at Audi AG in 1998.
In beautiful Ingolstadt.
I was able to work in Ingolstadt, which was much kind of the headquarters, I think, was much smaller than it is now. It's big and fancy. And there was no museum and all that stuff in Ingolstadt was not there. But the TT was about, you know, to be released. And so I worked on some of the interior components and such of the TT, which was exciting as a student. And then I came back to California. But when I was over there, I was trying to either get a job at BMW or Audi, and I couldn't make it. I was trying to figure it out, and I couldn't quite get the job at BMW in time, but I really wanted to work for BMW. And they came back and said, well, next year you should come back and work for us. And I jumped at the chance to do that.
Amazing.
And so the next summer I came back for a second internship, this time in Munich, in a facility around the corner from the Hochhaus and Fitz and such on Preußenstrasse. I don't know if you know, there's a little building over there that was for BMW M GmbH.
Oh, wow.
For the engine development, M engines.
Yeah.
And they gave me some little assignment for an American. And then at this exact same time, I don't know if you're aware of this, but this is 1999, 2000, BMW opened what they called the technology office.
I didn't know that, no.
Palo Alto, California.
Really?
About 2 miles from my university. They had about a dozen employees there, half of them German, half of them American. They were trying to get into technology and, you know, Bluetooth technology, which was brand new at that stage, and figuring out new architectures in the car for electronics and doing it in Silicon Valley. So Mercedes had an outpost, BMW had an outpost, VW now has an outpost. There's many tech outposts in Silicon Valley for cars, and they needed some help. So I applied for a job there and was given a job there straight out of school for 2 years, which was sort of a dream job to get a BMW job in California. Which
Amazing.
Is like, nobody has that. But my internships in Germany helped me get that first job.
Your internship at BMW M, was this about in the end of the 90s?
Munich would have been summer of 1999.
Wow.
That department had just won Le Mans, you might remember.
Yes, exactly. That's what I was thinking of.
And they had the Le Mans engine, and it was this big celebration, and people were very excited. So that was a fun time to be there.
To give a full picture, what did you study?
I studied mechanical engineering.
Oh, okay. That fits.
Maschinenbau, right? You call it Maschinenbau.
Absolutely. I mean, your German is immaculate. We do another recording session in German then. I would love to hear that. But I mean, you spoke about the vibe already, like winning Le Mans, all these things like an upwind, and everything is going very happy. How was it for a young American student who is into cars coming to, I don't want to say the motherland, let's say one parent land of the automobile. How was that for you?
I was shaken a little bit when I got to be nervous and walk into the, you know, human resource department, and they gave me my pass that said BMW Group on it, or whatever it said on it. And I kind of couldn't believe it. I had had that experience 1 year before, but BMW was a whole nother level. And being in Munich and riding the U-Bahn to work and walking to this special, that building, even not being in the main headquarters, but kind of being around the corner, it felt like sort of a secret workshop.
Yes. The Q department.
Yes. And I would go, you know, go down to the garage beneath it, and they had, you know, secret cars with covers over them, and they had M3s with V8s in them, which they weren't, you know, those were secret at the time. And they had some other, you know, concepts which were sort of underground and people didn't know. It felt like I was really in the heart of all the, you know, the car magazines I had read as kids that had sketches and drawings and secret things going on overseas. I got to see it. And I was what, 20 years old? I was 19 years old. I mean, it was crazy.
I think I can relate to it because I was 17 when I did my first trip to the US with my parents at that time. But it was definitely dedicated to visit family, because parts of my family emigrated before the war, actually, the Second World War, to the US. But then my father, who knew my love for cars, of course, we went to Michigan. Of course, we went to Detroit. We went to all the factory tours. And, you know, as someone who is a big fan of big trucks, I admit it, seeing F-150, seeing the Broncos, seeing all these kind of cars, it was absolutely amazing. And now I really can relate to what you felt when you saw BMW and Mercedes taxis, which I really like, super luxury cars in the US, and then you see them as a taxi. I mean, the American cars built for a certain purpose still are. Then we have the cars from Europe built for a certain purpose, still do. And they're still so different. And this is what I really love. If you look at a Ford built in Europe, completely different than any Ford that's going to be built in the US.
Absolutely. I loved it. And I love that sort of different flavor that I was able to see. Obviously, growing up out here, European cars are very popular in California, right? But they, again, serve a different purpose. The Autobahn experience and just the engineering mindset of walking around BMW and Audi back at that time, and the way people were thinking, and the way my, you know, little office worked, and the way ideas were shared, it felt obviously very different. It was new for me because I was, one, young, but two, the American perspective is a little bit different than that. So it was, I felt very lucky to be able to do that.
And what was your first Autobahn experience? I think that's also something for Americans very important.
It's very important, and it still is. You know, long live the Autobahn. I'm a big fan. We lived outside of Stuttgart when I was like 2 years old, 3 years old. My father took an assignment over there for Hewlett-Packard, the computer company.
Yeah.
And helped, you know, run sales for them in Europe. And so I was a little boy riding around in the back of a Mercedes station wagon on the Autobahn. And so I remember that. That has stuck with me ever since. Yeah. I wish the smooth surface of the Autobahn is what fascinates me, JP. I don't know. You've ridden on American roads and they're all terrible. I don't know what roads are like in the Middle East where you are now, but California roads are just dreadful. And I don't know how in the cold weather and the wet and the hot weather and everything in Germany, the surface must have the smartest engineers figuring out how to make it like glassy, perfect and smooth. You guys do the best job in the world at that.
Absolutely. I mean, road construction here is based on extensive research. It's actually a major, engineering achievement. The surfaces of the road are adapted to all the regional characteristics. Is there a lot of rain? The asphalt can deal with the rain very easily because of a drainage system. And what I like best on the Autobahn, it has been built like a racetrack, because you can do 130, 140 in an ordinary car, like a Golf, easily, even in a hard bend. So it's no problem, because they really build it like a racetrack in a sense.
That's really cool. The other thing that always strikes me is the painted lines on the Autobahn are very long. It's like it's like an airport runway.
Yes.
So it makes you feel, even if you're going over 100 miles an hour, it feels like it's very controlled. In America, the stripes are about 50 centimeters long.
Yeah, exactly.
So if you're going fast, these stripes are going by so rapidly that you feel out of control if you're going fast, right? Yeah. It feels like you're taking a risk. But on the Autobahn, it's so smooth and long. Like it's all designed to make you feel in control and comfortable at high speed. And I just, as an engineer type geek like I am, I love everything about that.
And then came Palo Alto with the opportunity to work for BMW in the US. So what, and you said you were working on things like Bluetooth and all this future technology at that time. I think it makes perfect sense to have something close to Silicon Valley if you want to get it connected. And I have to say BMWs are the best in that terms. And I don't say that because this is the BMW podcast, but I really can honestly say, driven many cars, connectivity is the best in a BMW, followed by an Audi, followed by a Land Rover, funny enough.
So, wow, you think that is the podium right there?
Yes,
you
think? I think so, yeah. Because
Mercedes snubbed from the podium, just like in F1,
yeah,
huh?
Yeah. Let's go back to the Bluetooth thingy in Palo Alto. So you worked there for 2 years, you said?
Yes, and they were doing much more than that. I don't want to just call it that. There were so many projects that they were working on. It was called the Palo Alto Technology Office for BMW AG. Mm-hmm. And it was very exciting. We got to travel to Germany with two cars that we had built, sort of show display vehicles.
Yes.
A 7 Series, an E38 7 Series, and an early X5. Both of those were our display vehicles, and we brought them to the FITS and explained what we were doing to share knowledge and transfer the knowledge to Germany. And it was an amazing first role for me. And it was a very important part. You know, I mean, iDrive had just come out. You talk about how BMW's, you know, has great interconnectivity and technology. That was brand new, and it was difficult to prove to people that this was going to be the future. But now you look in all the cars and how they work. Much of that technology has been here to stay in a lot of vehicles, but the first iPhone, even if you look back at it these days, it's a little crazy.
Yes.
But similarly, BMW was on the cutting edge of trying new ways to, utilize electronics. And that's, something that was important. So it was fun to work in that area.
So I remember that I was invited, in my time when I was working more on the journalistic front at Classic Driver, we were invited to test, I forgot the name, what it was, the BMW product for connectivity, at least. So the car that understands that if it falls over, it does a SOS call. So like an emergency call, is everything all right? You have like a concierge service that helps you to navigate where's the next petrol station, all those kind of things. And I mean, these are exciting times. And now hearing that it might be true that Apple is dropping out of the car building race, I think it's even more important because seriously, my rental car decisions is, does it have CarPlay or not?
It's important. Yes. Yeah, people want to have that sort of communication and personalization and all these sorts of things in cars. That's very, very important. And friends that worked at the BMW office then went on to, you know, Apple and Tesla and all these other places. And then some people have gone back and forth between back into BMW. So it's always fun to still have connections and ties there, even though I departed and, you know, did different things at BMW and then crazy, you know, auction things on Bring a Trailer, which are pretty, pretty separate from that.
Yeah. And I think we should jump into this one now. So to put it into a chronological order, you started sending out a newsletter at what time?
It was 2007 we turned it on. So I had been at BMW for, 7 years at that point and was actually going to school in the evenings, was getting an MBA in the evenings, but always had this, itch to look for classic cars instead of doing my homework, So,
of course.
So I was doing that and I co-founded it with a good friend of mine. And we were kind of the magic combination of I was into cars and finding cars and sort of the marketing and voice. And he was more on the technology side and the psychology side of how we could build a website that would be appealing to people.
Yeah.
And our combination and our friendship is what made it happen.
That's fantastic if something is based on friendship. So, but the name Bring a Trailer does sound for an American super easy peasy. They understand immediately what that means. But for a European, quite tricky, I would say. Explain that phrase.
So we were thinking about what to call this thing, right? And I told you about my passion ever since I was a very young child, reading what we call classified ads, right?
Yes.
Which are fixed price ads,
you
know, classic driver or mobile.de or AutoScout24, all these places. That started before the internet, that for us, that was in newspapers, right? We would get a newspaper when I was growing up in our driveway every morning. And I would look at that, and there was a section in the back where you could rent a house or you could, you know, do whatever. And one of them was for cars. And then one of them was for classic and collectible cars. There was this little column for special. And this, there were no photos. This was just words, right? Because you would pay by the word and by the line.
Yeah.
And people would take advantage of paying for these characters. It wasn't like free to write as long as you want. You had to pay by the letter. So people would abbreviate and come up with a special language and sort of vernacular for how to write that. And there were terms you would get that you wouldn't get anywhere else. They were just specific to writing classified listings for cars. And one of those, if it was a project car or if it was a race car or if it was, you know, something not legal to drive on the streets or something crazy like that, they would write right in the listing, they would write, bring a trailer. They would, that was like a, it was like a call to action, right? Yeah. It was, and that come the year 95 or 2000 or whenever, when it went online, people wrote that online as well. And I, in the early days of searching for cars online, one of my search terms on our classified sites in America would be to type in, search for who wrote Bring a Trailer. Because if they wrote that in a listing, it probably means it's either a, you know, Porsche Speedster in their backyard that hasn't run in 40 years, or maybe it's a race car, right? Maybe it's something cool or a Ferrari or who knows what.
Genius. How did you turn that into a business model?
So good question. We didn't have a business model at the beginning. It was more like therapy. It was therapy for me because it was fun and it would give me something, a purpose to all my internet searching that I was doing. But it grew and people liked it and people liked the kind of cars I found because I didn't have the money to buy them. But if I found JP's dream car and said, this is a bargain, go buy this.
Yes.
That's an interesting thing to read in the morning. So people decided to start reading it and sharing it with their friends and then said, hey, would you put my car on Bring a Trailer? Like instead of hoping that you find my car for your audience when it's on eBay or wherever, can you just list it directly? And that's when the light bulb went off for us that we said, oh, maybe this can be a marketplace and we could turn it into a little bit of a business so that we could, you know, pay for a couple of, you know, laptop computers to run it off of.
I mean, and look at where it is now. I mean, in 2023, Bring a Trailer had staggering 1.2 million registered users. That's a massive number. And it works like this. So you offer your car for sale in an auction, not for a fixed price, so everyone can bid on it. Yet the really USP of Bring a Trailer is that the community comment on cars that are for sale. That means you as a buyer have the security, and by the way, also as the seller, that you have the common knowledge of the community shared below your listing.
Ever since the beginning, one of the most important things for me was transparency and helping to list cars online in a better way because it was very mysterious and there were so many, you know, falsehoods and bad characters and such selling cars online in particular. And so we wanted to create a format that worked against that and made it better for the buyer and a more complete picture of a vehicle. So if you say, hey, I owned one of those and the, you know, the steering wheel on this one is wrong and the guy put the brakes on backwards or whatever, that's not positive, but that's helpful, right? Yeah, so that's helpful for the buyer. So we have fostered a sort of culture of people knowing what they can say. And we have a team that watches and reads every discussion because the human component and the expertise of knowing what's a good dialogue and what's helpful and encouraging that is honestly, it's the most important part of Bring a Trailer is that community aspect.
You work with a lot of data, I assume, correct? At Bring a Trailer. I mean, this is like a source of data that must be amazing.
I mean, there's been 140,000 listings and everything on BAT is permanent. So you can go look up back to the first one. It's all, that was a real frustration of mine on other auction houses and other platforms is something would sell and then you wouldn't know what happened or it would be erased or however. So that transparency thing, again, having it be permanent is important. So there is very rich data around every listing, every comment, every component of it is there online. Yes.
Randy, when you look at this data, could you see tendencies? Could you see what's spiking at the moment? For example, which is the most watched or looked BMW model at the moment in Bring a Trailer?
Yes, you can absolutely do that. You can slice it by every different model, right? Like every model of BMW has its own page with a scatter chart of all the results and the prices and different things like that. Yeah, you can look at, you know, watcher counts. You can sort by popularity. You can sort by, you know, very granularly. You can compare, you know, all the E30 M3 Evos of a particular color and how they've sold from 2014 until now. So it's super interesting from a data perspective. And I've always liked that part of it. And we have a lot of users that many users make suggestions and say, hey, can you help me to sort it in this way? And so we'll build that because the community sort of wants it. And I think that's something that is helpful to the automotive community in general. It's not just about, you know, selling the cars on BAT, but it's a helpful component.
And would you say that also trends have influence on that? So do you see, for example, I think a couple of years ago, everyone was dressed up with a beard and go to a barber shop where like 30s inspired fashion or the freedom of the revival of the 70s. Do you see also that in terms of cars?
Absolutely. I mean, there are trends that kind of come and go, right? And people are always trying to guess what the next trend is, right? Maybe, I don't know if that's your next question, but people always ask me, Randy, what's the next trend going to be?
And obviously, it was never intended to ask a question.
that's a tricky one though. You probably get asked that question also, right? Like people always want to know, but there are, you know, there was sort of a bubble in, you know, right after COVID in 2022 and that has settled. There was obviously a big Porsche run up of values and that has settled. And there in America, there was, we talk about trucks. There was this really big bubble on trucks that ran up in, call it 2018, 2019. And then that has settled a little bit. But new things come all the time. Yeah. And maybe it follows fashion or it follows Hollywood or it follows whatever, you know. But there are always different things that are kind of bubbling up to the top and then settling down a little bit.
I can imagine that seeing a new trend coming up is very inspiring, obviously, but also very tempting. At least for me, it would be very tempting. How many cars have you bought yourself via Bring a Trailer?
You know, at big auctions, I'm always nervous and skeptical that they're bidding against their customers, and it's a bad dynamic. So we have a rule where I don't bid on Bring a Trailer. But if a car misses reserve and is still for sale after an auction, I'm allowed to contact the person. And so there's probably four or five cars that I've bought that have come through the Bring a Trailer channels, which is fun. And people on our team can kind of have one of those every once in a while, but we can't run a real business if all of our employees are just taking all the good cars, you know? So we kind of have to have some rules against that.
Absolutely. So speak about your personal garage. If you look down at your garage now, what's parked there?
Well, for this podcast, let me start off with a BMW. BMW is very near and dear to me. As German cars are, but one of my favorite ones, maybe a little bit of an underdog, you have to tell me, I have a E28 535IS sedan, which is, I think, only a US model. I don't think they did
only
the
US.
IS.
Yes.
We got M5s here, as you may know, but they only painted them in black.
Yes.
We only got black M5s, which I thought was a weird marketing decision because the European M5s were in every color you could want and individual colors and everything. And it's so special for us. So I have a white with black interior 535IS with Alpina 16-inch wheels on it and European bumper conversion and it looks like a European M5 in white, but it's just a 535IS here in America. And that's one of my sort of iconic sedan, from the era 1987 when BMW was, you know, on top of motorsport and doing very cool things. And I love that. So sorry, talking a little bit long about that one, but I'm very passionate about it.
I think it was like, it has to do with the emission regulations, maybe, or safety regulations in California, that they don't introduce an M in that sense, in that direction. But this car is absolutely amazing. I mean, the way it stands. Not sure about you. You stick to the American bumper, the US version bumper.
No, I converted it all to European components,
and it
looks so much better.
Yes,
there's a very special photograph that I based my vehicle off of.
Yes,
which was one of the earliest ring taxis at the Nürburgring. I don't know if you're familiar with the ring taxi program with M5s.
Yeah,
you know, taking people around the ring. There is one of those with an E28 M5 in white. It looks very similar to my vehicle, but and it says Ring Taxi on the side. And it's like one of the very first. It must have been in 87 or 88 or whenever that was.
Yeah. I think 88.
That was always my sort of favorite E28 of them all. This one photograph I have from the internet. So I kind of, did the bumpers and did the wheels and did everything to kind of look like that car. So that's a special moment.
Super. Do you have also the lip and the back?
Yes. Perfect. That came on it. Yep.
Very good. Yeah. No, I think this car looks so great with the Alpina wheels on it. I have to say that looks absolutely stunning. And for me, I really like the shark nose era of BMW. And this is one of the last one where you really like kind of see it a little bit. No, congratulations to that car. I wish you that you collect as many positive memories as possible in that car, because it's amazing to have that one. But let's go through the other parts of the garage. I mean, that's a really cool car. A good start, I would say.
Well, my tastes are all over the place, right? We talk about trucks. We talk about German sedans. We talked about, I like 60s Alfa Romeo. So I have an early Giulietta. I have a Lotus Cortina, little fun little British saloon car, white green.
Yeah.
They sold very few of those in America with left-hand drive.
What is your daily?
A car you don't have in Europe, which is a Rivian, an electric SUV called a Rivian.
Mega.
I think you may get those soon, but that's what we have over here, and they're very popular.
Yes.
I'm not a big Tesla guy, so I like that there's a competitor for Tesla, and it's a very cool. I've never done an electric vehicle, and I wanted to test it. We sell these on Bring a Trailer. They're enthusiasts love them, and I use it to tow, display vehicles that we have and stuff. It's very fun.
Yeah. But let's stick to BMW, because with your 5 Series you own, what would you say is for you the next BMW high flyer in terms on the market? I mean, 507 SafeBed, 3.0 CSL SafeBed, M1 SafeBed. But what do you think will fly the next time? And don't say a 535 IS.
No, I won't say my own. You could say E28 M5, but I don't want to say that, because if the market runs away on those, I may never find one.
Yeah.
I think there's been a lot of energy around the E46 version of the CSL, the modern CSL. That car you've started to see show up in collector condition. The British are very hot for that car. They made some in right-hand drive, right? So that's very unusual. And then obviously the Germans, we never got that car in America. And I think some collectors here are waiting. Cars have to turn 25 years old, as you may know, to import them into America. So that car will do that in about 5 years from now.
Yeah.
And I think you'll see that car be very coveted and exciting. I think the E30 M3 saw a big bubble and then it settled down. But I think that will continue to be a meaningful sort of collector grade car. And looking for, there's one for sale in the UK right now. I follow this market obsessively. The real DTM raced motorsport cars.
Yeah.
There's one for sale in Britain right now that raced in Italy and won the championship in Italy and did some cool things. There's many fakes out there, but finding the real ones of the cars that were campaigned and raced, and even the BTCC E46 touring cars, the 2-liter cars.
Yeah.
Those are very special with the motorsport flag livery over the corners and the Warsteiner beer on the door and all that sort of stuff. I think there's room for BMW motorsport tradition type cars to be more visible out in the marketplace and found and transacted. I don't know if those are all hiding in Munich or where those are all hiding, but we need more of them.
I wish I could tell you, but I really can't. And I asked myself the same question, and also spreading this out to the collector world, but this really like strange. And maybe they got disassembled or something like this. I'm not sure. You know, some of the BMWs were the perfect car to buy it from the pre-owned market and then tune it. Like there was a big tuning scene around Dortmund, Düsseldorf, Cologne, all that. But I think it's a really good question. So everyone tuned in. Randy and I have a question for you. Where are all these cars we just mentioned? Where are all the motorsport related cars?
And something interesting on that is that, I mean, the BMW collection, the classic collection, I'm sure you've had access to that. I've actually never walked through that in the basement in Munich or at the Hochhaus or wherever it is. They obviously have a bunch of wonderful examples, and it's really great that they take them out on display and take them to events and run them at hill climbs and run them at, you know, they brought them to Monterey, right?
And in terms of race cars, I mean, where are all these Group 5 race cars, all the 320s turbos, where are they? Mm-hmm. I mean, I know that for a fact, working together with Jägermeister and Rennmeister on that collection, I know where one is, but where are all these cars? I mean, they were so competitive and so many around. And I have to say, and the Group 5 is the most radical, beautiful car, 70s BMW style, and I like it very much.
Yeah, me too. The 320 Turbo was just wild with the wings and the... didn't it have different size wheels, front and rear? Didn't it have a much...
Yes, front much small, larger, yes. Amazing. Look at it.
Yeah, cool.
In the Classic Heart podcast, we speak a lot about modern modification like restomods and all these things. Yet, these modifications, in my opinion, had their high time if you look at the racing cars of the 1970s. I mean, the extreme wide fenders, Marshall spoilers. And for me, the Jägermeister car was one of the most striking Group 5 race cars. Actually, I never really understood how it worked back in that time to have like a spirits company sponsoring a race. But I mean, we had Jägermeister, we had Martini. It seems to be normal end of the 70s. Anyway, but I remember the 50th anniversary of Jägermeister racing and BMW M was celebrated in 2022 at the Villa d'Este. And the team principal, Eckhard Schimpf, presented his Jägermeister Group 5 car. He actually never raced it. He was the team principal, but he is a racer. And I think he went a bit too enthusiastic through the gardens of Villa d'Este and caused, let's say, the image of being the troublemaker there. But it was, of course, all fun. But Randy, let's get back to your business. Do you have any special plan with Bring a Trailer in 2024?
Yeah, 2024 is exciting. There will be things we're launching on the website. We always want to make it easier for people to transact and more trustworthy. There's also going to be a real international focus that will be interesting for your audience.
Yes.
We've been listing interesting vehicles in Europe, and we're making it easier for people to do that logistically with shipping and different things that they can do, which will be very helpful. But also just building up more support for buyers and sellers in Europe. And I've been in Europe a bunch in the last 18 months to help foster that. So that hopefully will come as soon as summertime. So I'm excited for that.
And I'm sure that for the Bring a Trailer European plans, many car enthusiasts here on this side of the pond are very, very excited about this. And with this promising perspective, I like to close our session, Randy. Thank you very much for joining, sharing your personal story and the success story of Bring a Trailer. And thank you for lots of fun and laughter. Randy Nonnenberg, thank you.
JP, this was really fun. And we love this podcast in America. And I tell my friends about it to listen to. You've had some great guests so far. So thank you for including me on that list.
It's our absolute pleasure, and please spread the word. That always helps. And once again, we want to encourage everyone who tuned in or knows someone who might has a BMW story to tell, please reach out to us and we get back to you. And we are looking always forward to get this input for new guests. And of course, if you like what you hear, please leave a 5-star rating. That helps also to spread the word about our little podcast. And if you haven't pushed the subscription button, please do so to never miss one of the Classic Heart episodes. And I would like to give special thanks to a fantastic team behind this podcast. Is Robin, who is the one who is orchestrating everything and managing everything in a fantastic way. We have Federica, who takes care of the quality of the content. And of course, Marcus and Alex from Scenario Studio, the sound engineers, to make this sound very well. So in the name of all of them, thank you very much. Randy, thank you and have a great day in sunny California.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.